What is happening, gang? We have got an awesome one for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. In today's episode, we finish building that tripod we've been talking about for the last few weeks. And in this episode, we focus on the third leg, which was in 1986, Marv Levy coming in mid-season and taking over from Hank Bullock as coach of the Buffalo Bills. It was a winding, twisty road that got Bill and Marv back together from their days in Kansas City and Chicago, and we learn a lot of inside scoop in this episode. From Bill's code name, I'll give you a clue, it might be Buckets, we'll find that out later in the episode, to all the permutations that went into bringing a coach in mid-season, what the process was like for the team, what are some of the reasons and rationale that are kind of important in today's NFL for replacing a coach midseason, and all the in-between therein. So sit back, relax, and get ready. This is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and this is step three of building the Bills. Marv Levy comes to Buffalo.
Two if by land, three if by sea, or whatever it was.
It's a strong analogy since we are building the third leg of the tripod today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. This is one that we've wanted to get to for quite some time. All of our fans in Buffalo have been clamoring for it. In today's episode, we kind of finish the third leg of this tripod we've been constructing in terms of the infrastructure of building the Bills dynasty. And so in this episode, we're going to take a look at one of the more monumental things in Buffalo Bills history as Marv Levy would come to Buffalo and take over as head coach of the Bills in mid-1986. But before we dive into that, I think we got to take a step further back in history. And to that end, Rick, kick us off.
Yeah, you know, so I was thinking about this, Bill. And I was thinking that pretty much any other place in the world, if you said to somebody, the Fab Four, that would be John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But in the 716 area code, that would mean Bill, Bruce, Jim, and Marv. Because now we had the pieces. So let's reconstruct the events that led to Marv coming to town. And for that, we need to kind of pick up where we left off at the conclusion of our last episode. I feel like the Saturday morning serials. But it was another mid-season head coaching change when the Bills brought in Hank Bullock to replace Kay Stevenson. Bill, just to get us in the moment back then, take us through those two guys, their personalities, their leadership styles, how the team responded, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the two couldn't have been more different. Kay Stevenson was a former quarterback and a former offensive coordinator. He was very low-key, very intelligent, one of the finest men I've ever been around in terms of the way he treated people and the way he conducted himself. A really good football man, had a really great grasp of the passing game. Understood personnel exceptionally well, was not real strong on defense, but we did pretty well when Don Lawrence and Monty Kiffin and Pete Carroll were there on the defensive staff. They all departed, and Hank became the defensive coordinator under Kay. Hank had a completely different style of defense, and it was, if we use today as an example, very similar to, although not as wild and woolly, but very similar to what Rex Ryan uses, a blitzing approach, a 3-4. That was not the kind of people that we had. So there was a disconnect almost immediately in the installation of the system. And Hank was not interested in any other system or accommodating his system to the personnel in any way. So he was going through contemplated a complete overhaul of personnel on the defensive side of the ball. Offensively, he brought in a quarterback coach named Bob Leahy, who was a good solid coach, but was kind of a different personality, very different than John Becker, who had held the job previously. under Kay. And while Jim Ringo and Elijah Pitts remained on the staff, we brought in a new tight end coach, a new receiver coach. So there was a lot of turnover and turmoil, and I learned a good lesson from that. The more turnover and turmoil you have, the less progress you make. Now, in terms of his the way he dealt with the team, Hank was very dogmatic, and liked to really talk to the team a lot, which is very different than most pro coaches, certainly the ones I've been around. Marv Levy always talked about not wanting to be a noise. Kay Stevenson always talked about not wanting to put too much on their plates, meaning the players. He was very worried about distracting them. He wanted them focused on the task at hand. Cal Murphy, with whom I worked in both Montreal and in Winnipeg in the CFL and as a member of the CFL Hall of Fame, God rest his soul, he too has passed away, was exactly like Marv and Kay. He was the same personality, low-key, don't be a noise, talk only about the things that are important to winning. Don't get them off track under any circumstances. Hank was just the opposite. He would have a meeting with them on Wednesday where he'd introduce the game plan, and he'd talk about things like drug addiction and people not obeying the law and things. You know,
yeah.
He was trying to make points. He was trying to use current events and things like that to make points, but it didn't connect with the players. And of course, he was talking to a much different generation than he'd grown up with. He was a child of the Depression and was very focused. As such, he was very focused on financial security. And he talked to them a lot about that. And you know, most of it fell on deaf ears, as you might imagine. He was sincere. He was sincere in his message, but it just didn't translate. And then on top of that, when he would get excited, he would commit commit's a bad word. He would use malaprops. So for example, after one losing game, someone said to him, listen, you had it going along pretty good there until the second quarter, and then everything fell in. And he said, yeah, they really took the sails out of our wind. And there were so many of those publicly that somebody even put together one of those little bitty books, you know, that you put together it was Words from Hank or something like that. I can't remember what the title was, but
Deep Thoughts.
It didn't play well, obviously.
Right. Right.
Again, he meant well. His heart was in the right place, but when it was all said and done, he didn't really have the capabilities, the communication capabilities, to be a head coach. And then his reliance totally on the concept of defense that he wanted, and the personnel that he wanted, to the exclusion of other issues, became a problem, because you know, players like Bruce Smith and Daryl Talley don't come along every day of the week. and it's a player's game when it's all said and done. It's not the X's and O's, it's the Johnnies and Joes, as the saying goes. And he wanted to get rid of Daryl Talley, and Daryl knew it. And that made for, not a good relationship. Also, Hank had, like George Allen, by the way, would frequently mispronounce players' names. Like, we had a defensive end named Sean McNanny, who he always called Nanny. And that was not the only one. That became a sort of a bone in some players' throats. So generally speaking, by the time we entered the '86 season,
right,
I think it's fair to say it wasn't a happy ship for a lot of reasons, and not always Hank's fault. There were people who loved Kay who couldn't wait to criticize Hank. There were people who didn't like Hank who couldn't wait to criticize Hank. You know, there were people in the organization who disliked coaches, period, who couldn't wait to criticize.
Right.
So it wasn't all Hank. There was enough blame to go around for everybody. And that needed to change if we were ever gonna succeed.
I mean, on paper, this could have been something. I kind of surmise that this idea of a defensive-oriented coach with a kind of perceived savior star quarterback in Jim Kelly, from a paper standpoint, had Coach Bullock not necessarily had some of these other problems, could have been a recipe just even conceptually from a general manager's perspective. Is that one that you like, or is that something where when you have a defensive-oriented coach, a very strong player at the quarterback position, is that something that kind of creates conflict?
Well, you're right on both counts. And it's an interesting conundrum. I've thought about it often. The communication issue was the biggest one. In the last episode, we talked about the press conference in Buffalo when Jim arrived, and people were bandying about, you know, the word savior. Our savior's here. The guy who's going to lead the franchise out of the wilderness to the promised land is here. All those biblical references. And Hank spoke, and he welcomed Jim. And then he said, it's important to remember that Jim is not our savior. He's not the guy that's going to win championships for us single-handedly. No quarterback can do that, no matter how good he is. And we got to have a great defense. We got to have a great running game. We got to be able to sack the quarterback. And he highlighted all of the things that defensively you needed to do to win, which was his orientation. But it really, I don't want to say it's the skunk at the garden party, because it wasn't that bad, but it registered with people as, gee, Jim Kelly's here. What are you talking about defense for? You know, that kind of thing. Now, he was right. He wasn't wrong conceptually. But then Bob Leahy, who was a quarterback coach, and I can't tell you whether this is at Hank's direction or otherwise, was he and Jim did not hit it off. They just didn't. And that'll happen from time to time. And Bob wasn't going to budge, and Jim certainly wasn't budging, and so it didn't make for a happy ship, and that was the bottom line. And Hank, like most defensive oriented coaches and defensive oriented general managers, by the way, hated interceptions. Absolutely hated interceptions. Not that Jim threw many, but you know, he was going to throw the ball down the field, and you're going to get some of those from time to time when you do that. So that became a bit of an irritant. So I guess the best analogy is to say that there are lots of sticks being rubbed together. And sooner or later, if a lot of those keep rubbing up against each other, you're going to get a fire. And that's what occurred.
Right.
So let me drill down on that for a second. So look, as the record book reflects, and as all Bills fans will remember, you know, 86 after turns out to be another tough slog. So in terms of the stuff, I think you've really set it up in general. But can you give us any more in the way of specifics that this tension, this, let's even say animosity, played out on the field, in the locker room, in the general chemistry of the team? Because I think this is a great example of, this wouldn't just be the Bills, this would be any place where a head coach is trying to impose a scheme that doesn't necessarily fit. He doesn't seem to want to let the guy who you need to get credit, even if it's over, given to a quarterback. And so this is all there. So how does it play out in those three areas, the locker room, on the field, and the general chemistry around the team?
Well, the field was obvious. You know, the results were obvious. We were not playing good football. We were making far too many mistakes. That's usually because guys aren't tuned in, and they in reality they weren't as well as they should have. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that there was little chemistry. There were groups of people that, particularly on the defensive side, and some who had Hank had brought in, who had played for him in Cincinnati, who were good guys, who would counsel, take it easy. You know, yeah, he's different. Yeah, you know, he talks too much. Yeah, you know, he'll get on you or mispronounce your name, but he's really at heart a good guy and a good coach. All of that was true, by the way. There were a group of those guys. Another group of guys who said, hey, listen, I don't care who the coach is. I get paid to play every week, and I want to get my paycheck every week, and so I'm going to go out there and do what I can, but I'm not taking sides on anything. I'm showing up for work and doing my job. And then there was a third group that said, no, this guy's not the right guy for us, and I don't like him, and so on and so forth. So that's by definition a prescription for failure. But it got to the point where they rubbed up against each other so often that it Hank and you know, a growing group of players, that it just wasn't going to work. And I was observing this from afar. I was around every day and at practice every day, but had no real involvement with it. I'm watching from afar, hurting badly with all the losses and all of what was going on, but I wasn't prepared to do anything about it. Except to just watch and take notes and learn from it. And then a delegation of players, which we would, in today's terms, we would call a bipartisan delegation, which did not include any of the stars. They were more like, the newer stars, they were more like elder statesmen, came to me and said, this is not working, Bill. Something's got to change. And that was the catalyst. So I went to Mr. Wilson and told him that. I said, I feel an obligation, you know, to tell you that this is what the players have said. And I told him who the players were, and he recognized it and understood it, and understood what was going on. He liked Hank very much. Hank had been his choice. He forced Kay to take Hank as the defensive coordinator, so he was very much a Hank fan. But he'd been around long enough. There was a ton of wisdom in Mr. Wilson, much of which the public never got to see. But he'd been around long enough to realize when, in fact, the remark he made to Dave Olson and I was, "What, you know, when you've lost the players, you've lost everything." And then he told a great joke, which I'll share with you, that people that around the Bills have heard it 100 times, but it's always funny. Lou Saban had been the coach of the Bills twice, and Lou was a very emotional guy. And so they were mired in a bit of a losing streak the second time Lou was the coach, and he came into Ralph and he said to Mr. Wilson, "Ralph, I'm quitting. That's it. I'm done." And Ralph said, "No, Lou, don't do that. Take it easy. Just being emotional. What's the problem?" He said, I've lost the team. And Ralph said to him, "Where did it go?"
That's pretty good. In terms of your experience with this, how unusual is it
for a group of players to kind of band together and then come to you as the GM. I mean, that seems to me like that's a pretty extreme step that can't be par for the course in the league.
Well, it's not unheard of. And there really are two reasons for making, or three reasons actually, for making an in-season coaching change. The first and most obvious one is if management, ownership and management, has decided that the coach lost the team, that they're no longer listening. And you can, even when you look at changes that will be made this year, keep that in mind. That's the principal reason, and almost always the reason you make an in-season change. The second reason is if there's some untoward incident that occurs where removal is called for. That's rare. And then the third would be where you've had so much losing for so long with the same coach that just the fan base requires a change. And that's the most hurtful one of all, because you might be on the verge of success, but you never know whether you are or not. That's what happens, but far more often than not, it's because the coach has lost the team, and who knows why? I mean, no one can predict that. No, you know it when you see it, but no one can predict that. So the players, a group of players coming to me indicated two things. One, that they had some faith that I was a football guy and would listen to what they had to say. And second, that there wouldn't be any repercussions about it, which I thought was, in retrospect, I thought, okay, we're at least headed down the right trail in that regard, that they think that they're respected and people will listen to them. But I wasn't about to act on that. I said it needs to be talked over with Mr. Wilson, and that's what I did.
Right. And Bill, in this case, there were three categories, although Hank really hadn't been there long enough to blame, the losing after losing after losing on him. But in terms of losing, the team was certainly there, and sort of a slight rebellion against him. But right, wasn't there also a conflict with a player that exacerbated and sort of triggered this?
Well, he and Bruce and Darryl were having difficulty getting along. And he wanted to trade Darryl. I mean, he made that known to Mr. Wilson and to me, and he even suggested at one point to think about trading Bruce. That one was, it didn't get much traction, but he kept, he didn't think Darryl fit. He didn't think Darryl could do the job, and everybody else was kind of opposed to that idea. So it became a burr under his saddle, and Darryl knew it was going on. So it was, you can't keep those things quiet. So it became a burr under Darryl's saddle, and so it just, it made for a not a very healthy atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, and a guy like Darryl, both who he is and the way he plays, I mean, is going to be popular with his teammates who actually know he can do the job and want him to be there, let alone Bruce Smith. So, I mean, he wasn't picking the right candidates to single out, be abandoned.
Well, I, again, in Hank's defense, and he deserves some defense in all of this, Bruce was not at that time a National Honor Society pupil. He was, Hank pointed out, he wasn't in shape. He wasn't in the best shape he could be. Hank pointed out that, he often did not want to do the things Hank wanted him to do. That's absolutely true. It wasn't until Ted Trutrell came and coached the defensive line that and Marv threatened to trade Bruce that he got with it. So, Bruce wasn't a happy camper, but Hank wasn't wrong. But if you just compare the way Hank dealt with it as opposed to the way Marv dealt with it, that shows you the stark difference between the two.
So then in terms of, as this begins to unravel, obviously you've talked to Mr. Wilson, he's now involved. At what point did it sort of bubble up, okay, we need to look at potentially moving on? And then how did he loop you into that in terms of, did you have any recommendations or were there any ideas you had if you were to move on, what you'd want to do moving forward?
Yeah, when I talked to Mr. Wilson and told him what the players had told me and what observations I had had, he was prepared to make a change. And both Dave and I counseled, no, that's not right. You gotta sit down with Hank and explain to Hank that, look, you gotta mend your ways in some ways here. You know, you gotta be more communicative positively with the players. And we're not going to trade Talley, and we're not going to trade Bruce Smith. It's your job to motivate them, to get them going. And you know, give the team a break. Don't be talking for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, you know, when they could be looking at the opposition's film. But Mr. Wilson was focused on the interpersonal relationships. So he said, well, I'll talk to Hank about that. And he did. And apparently the conversation didn't go the way Mr. Wilson felt it should, because he said to Dave and I, we weren't successful. What you proposed isn't going to work. So at that point, I think he was mulling over whether or not to make a change, and he was pretty much there. Mr. Wilson was pretty much there. So it's at a subsequent meeting, he said to me, do you have anybody in mind? And I had only one person in mind. I mean, there was no question. in my mind, if you had asked me, as every general manager should, who was on the short list in my upper left-hand drawer in June of 1986, you know, I would have said Marty Schottenheimer and Marv Levy. And that was all. But Marty had been elevated to the head coaching job in Cleveland, so he was off the radar. And so there was only one other name, and that was Marv Levy. And I was absolutely convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that he could do the job. And I didn't like the recruiting of Jim Kelly. I didn't need to be a salesman, because my firm belief that Marv was the right person sold the idea. I just truthfully said he's everything we need and everything we want. Ralph knew him a little bit because he'd been the head coach at Kansas City, obviously. And he'd also done the color for us. He'd gone into broadcasting after he got fired, after the Blitz folded up. And so he did the color for us on our preseason telecasts, which are local. And Dave got to know him through that. And Dave, obviously, having exposure to him, thought highly of him. And he seconded my sales pitch, if you will, my recommendation.
But, Bill, didn't the fact that they knew that how close you were with Marv in a way present a hurdle, because it kind of came off as, wait a minute, is he really the best guy, or is he the guy you like the most? And you had to kind of overcome that burden, as I remember.
Well, I think so. Dave is the most rational person you'll ever run across, Dave Olson. And he asked that very question. He said, are you telling this because you're telling us this because you're a disciple of Marv Levy and you think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread? Dave didn't use those terms, but or is this your considered professional opinion? And I said, Dave, it's, and Mr. Wilson, it's the latter. You know, now, do I think the way I think because of my personal exposure to Marv? Yes, of course. But we won in Montreal. We were on the verge of winning in Kansas City before Joe Delaney unfortunately lost his life in a drowning accident. I saw him build that Kansas City team. I saw him motivate that team. I know what he can do. And furthermore, because he did the broadcast in the preseason, he knows our personnel. So it's not as though he's coming in here with no knowledge of what's going on. And in terms of being a complete head coach, as opposed to Kay, who had many of the same attributes as Marv, but not the defensive acumen that Marv did, and Hank, who's almost his complete opposite in the way he dealt with and treated the players, he's the perfect guy. So, I mean, they kind of accepted that, but Mr. Wilson went ahead and called Lamar Hunt, who was the owner of the Kansas City Chiefs and who hired and fired Marv. And so he asked for a reference. And Mr. Hunt said, Ralph, in all the years I've been in football, the biggest mistake I made was letting Marv Levy go.
Right, right.
And that cinched the deal.
That's a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that. And from Lamar Hunt. But and speaking of Joe Delaney, anytime it's mentioned when he said the tragic death, I always feel like I got to add the heroic tragic death of Joe Delaney. I mean, you know, with what he did. But didn't you also have Mr. Wilson call Marv directly, knowing that, you know, anybody who talked to Marv would understand his intelligence, his appreciation of human nature, you know, how to inspire people and so on. I mean, that had to be another arrow in your quiver, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Certainly it was. And Marv is his own best advertisement. All he has to do is open his mouth and you have a conversation with him and you come away incredibly impressed. So, that person-to-person interview, if you will, sold Mr. Wilson. And then Mr. Hunt's endorsement closed the deal. And then there was the question of, when or how you'd make the change. And so Marv called me back after he talked to Mr. Wilson, and he said, I'm in Montreal, and I'm about to take the general manager's job with the Alouettes. And he said, I don't know that once I accept it that I can turn it down, leave. So he said, I said, did you tell Ralph that? And he said, no, I didn't. So I said, well, all right, I'll share it with him. There's some urgency to make the decision, but don't accept anything there. I can't tell you it's a done deal, but I think it's pretty close. And so he said, okay, I won't say anything to these people here and I'll hold them off. So, but he said, I don't want anything getting out in the press either, because I don't want them to think that I'm trying to double cross them. They know that I would take an NFL job, but I don't want them to think I'm, trying to use them as a stalking horse or anything. And I said, no, I understand that. And here's the funny part of it. I said, if you get a call from, he was in a hotel in Montreal, so it would have to go through the switchboard in those days. I will call you. And if you get a call from Buckets Rosenberg, you know it's me.
I know that story, and I laugh every single time you say it.
There's a story involved with it. Buckets Rosenberg, I think, was a high school teammate or played against Marv in basketball in high school in Chicago. And he went on to become a very big star in basketball at the University of Illinois. And Marv and I always used to joke about when we were with the Blitz, and used to joke about nicknames of people and things of that nature. And so Buckets Rosenberg was kind of a character from his past that he'd shared with me. And it resonated for the two of us. And unless you were a post-World War II Illinois basketball fan, you wouldn't have understood the the reference at all.
Yeah. I think you're probably good. I think that's probably okay.
Yeah, that was a safe one.
So when Mr. Wilson called me, he said, all right, go ahead, call Marv, we'll do it. We were going to play the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in Tampa that weekend. He said, we'll make the change after this game. And so it was very late in the week. It might have been Friday or Saturday. We were just getting ready to leave for the game, I guess. So I called and left a message. It's Buckets Rosenberg, get ready to travel, or words to that effect.
I actually think you said pack a suitcase.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah.
But there was a little glitch in there. Bill, tell the story about the Tampa game and the comeback and your little worry about that.
Well,
remember that?
Yeah, sure. We went down and played at Tampa, and Jim has filled in some of the details for me later on, which were pretty funny. Naturally, as things got worse, there became rumors were floating around that there would be a coaching change. And I was always closed-mouthed with the press, but I was even more closed-mouthed in this circumstance. So they read the tea leaves pretty well and said, you know, something's up. So the players kind of knew that something was up, and the players knew that they had sent people to see me. And I told him that I was going to let Mr. Wilson know. I mean, that was my responsibility. And I think I may have even talked with Hank about it at that time. In any event, we go down and play Tampa, and we're sleepwalking. We're just, oh, God, what an awful first half. And Mr. Wilson on game day, sometimes even when we won, wasn't a happy camper. He'd get so emotional. So he's furious, you know. And so we go in at halftime, and you know, Tampa Bay was at that time the losingest franchise in all of sports, every single sport.
Yeah.
They really made no attempt to win. Ray Perkins was a darn good coach, but he had nothing to work with and no commitment by the organization or anything like that. So we go in at halftime, and as Jim Kelly tells the story, they're, you know, everybody's upset and carrying on, and nobody's paying any attention to Hank. And there's a bunch of guys, including Jim, saying, this is terrible, man. Come on. Don't you know, stop this. Let's go play. Let's go beat these guys.
Yeah.
And so we come out, and I think we score a touchdown right away to open the second half. We got a little life going, and everything's going on. And as Jim tells the story, Fred Smirla said to him, if you throw touchdown passes to win this game, I'll break your arm. So, of course, Jim just kept throwing him. So the game comes down to a pass on the goal line to score the winning touchdown. And the play was designed for Ronnie Harmon, I believe. But Rob Riddick was in the game. And Rob Riddick was playing with a cast on his hand. And he was the open guy. The play was designed for the back. Jim threw it to Rob. It bounced off the cast, hit the ground, and we lose the game. So at that point, you know, Mr. Wilson would have made the decision, but it just sealed the deal. But it was kind of funny that, you know, there were players saying to Jim, don't do this, don't do this.
It's pretty good.
Don't rehire Hank. Yeah.
So, but then as history would have it, you know, Coach Bullock would be fired the next day and Marv was hired. You know, so we've just been through this unbelievable savior reaction to Jim Kelly coming to Buffalo. What would you say the reaction of fans were to when the announcement was made that Marv was coming in? And, you know, what is kind of a little bit of an unusual move of bringing somebody in from the outside while he had called the preseason games to take over a team midseason?
Well, first of all, my mindset was, we're going full speed ahead. We've now made the change that's necessary to make us successful. So, again, I was exceedingly positive. Larry Felser, the columnist in the newspaper, was exceedingly negative. And he said this was just me hiring a friend who was essentially washed up, and that there would be complete misuse of Jim Kelly because Marv had used the wing T in Kansas City. Well, that's only partially true. He used the wing T the first year, or the running game attached to the wing T the first year in Kansas City, because we did not really have a drop back quarterback, and we were using a Steve Fuller, who was the number one draft choice, who was a rollout quarterback. So it fit perfectly. Turned out Fuller wasn't ready to play, and Tom Clements, his backup, played quite a bit. Tom had been a star in the CFL. Marv knew him. He signed him, liked him very much. He went back up to the CFL, as a side note, with the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and was setting records there. And we lost our quarterback in Winnipeg almost the day that Cal Murphy and I arrived. Dieter Brock refused to report. So we ended up trading 11 players to Hamilton for the rights to Tom Clements, and he took the Bombers to two more Grey Cups. Anyway, strange. You cross paths in strange ways in professional football, because in many ways it's a very small industry, particularly at the very top. In any event, the second year, Bill Kenny had won the job in Kansas City, and we went back to a traditional offense, and the wing T never saw the light of day except for some goal line and short yardage plays. But it was an easy tag to put on Marv. And so the newspaper did. And as I said in a previous episode, they drove the news cycle. Their opinions were what the echo chamber of radio and television would regurgitate. So it's safe to say that Marv's hiring by the fans was met with mixed reaction. Many people said, well, we need a new coach, but who says it's Marv Levy? You know, that's kind of the reaction.
So, and I think there was a lot in the press at the time that, you know, in Kansas City, Marv was 31-42. He wasn't a winner there, the single wing stuff and everything. But your belief in Marv, not only was justified, but was established basically, if not at the moment he got there, the in the time when he met with the team for the first time. Tell us about that meeting and what Marv said and how the team responded to Marv.
And did he tell any depression stories?
No, he did not. We went down to meet with the team. They knew that Hank had been relieved of his duties. The team and the staff were there. We weren't going to make any other coaching changes. Marv was just replacing Hank. The staff was remaining intact. And so I came into the room and basically gave a very brief rundown of Marv's biography. And I said, here's your new coach, Marv Levy. And I believe this is the first step down the road towards success for us. So Marv got up there and he said, I'm not going to be very long-winded here. I'll be brief. I'm paraphrasing now, but as you'll be able to tell, I remember it like it was yesterday. He said, our goal from this moment forward is to win the Super Bowl. not to have a winning season, not to win the division, to win the Super Bowl. Everything that we're going to do is going to be aimed at winning the Super Bowl. He said, now let me tell you something. What it takes to win is simple, but it isn't easy. You have to do a lot of fundamental things in order to win football games, in order to win the Super Bowl. And here are some of the most important ones. We have to run and stop the run. We have to play smart football. We're going to lead the league in fewest penalties. We're not going to be dumb, and we're not going to be dirty. We're going to be in the top five in the league in turnover margin. We're going to create turnovers on defense, and we're not going to turn the ball over on offense. Because if you win the turnover margin, you're going to win the game 90% of the time. If you run more often in a game, not run for more yards, but run more often, you're going to win 90% of the time. We're going to be in the top five in the league in the kicking game. Defense wins championships. Offense sells tickets. Defense wins games. Kicking wins championships. And he said, as far as how you go about your job, I have three rules. Be on time. Be a good citizen. Obey the law. Obey the rules. Don't cheat the game. Don't cheat yourself. Set a good example for all the people that follow us here. And finally, whenever you're in this building, whenever you're doing something that has to do with the Buffalo Bills, give 100% effort all the time. No more, no less. Now, let's go beat the Pittsburgh Steelers. The players stood up and applauded. They gave him a standing ovation.
That does not happen.
Yeah, and I didn't give the talk nearly as well as he did. I can't replicate his inflection or his emotion or even his delivery, but I was astounded. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. They stood up and applauded, and guys walked up and shook his hands. Welcome, coach. Nice to have you here. Let's go. Walk out the door. That cloud that was over the franchise was lifted. Nobody else in Buffalo knew but us, the people in that room, but the cloud had lifted.
Well, it had to be nerve-wracking for you just in this situation. He's your guy. He's coming in. It's mid-season. Established team, established roster, established coaching staff. I mean, I wonder if that speech doesn't go like that, if you just don't get off on the right foot, if that bad juju continues, that's one of those sort of quintessential moments where everything's got to align. And you had to have been a little nervous going into it.
I wasn't. Honestly, I was not. I believed totally that he was the right guy. And it may have been the following game when we beat the Steelers. Here's what happened in the game. It's a great story. It was close to Veterans Day, soon there, near it or just after it, which is when the first storm comes across Lake Erie and changes the climate in Buffalo. And the stadium is located very near the shores of Lake Erie. It's in the South Towns. As a matter of fact, it's located on a plot of land that was owned by the state. And the reason no one developed it is because it's the heart of the snow belt. That's why it was available to put the stadium there. And so it is not uncommon to start a game at that time of the year where the temperature will be in the 70s or high 60s. And by halftime, it's down into the 20s and the wind's blowing 35, 40 miles an hour. And the wind comes out of the tunnel end zone, the southwest end zone. The storms come across the lake from Cleveland, pick up moisture crossing Lake Erie and dump it on Hamburg, New York, and Orchard Park, New York. So the we're playing the Steelers. We had a person, Rick knows him, Steve Champlin, who was our operations guy, who was monitored the weather constantly. He was in touch with the National Weather Service on an ongoing basis. And you might wonder, well, how does a guy from the Buffalo Bills get an open line to the National Weather Service? Well, in Buffalo, that's what happens. So.
Bill, that's also the kind of thing Steve Champlin does.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So we knew that the wind was going to kick up in the second half, so Marv made the decision to, you know, choose the wind. And we played like the devil. And I think we might have been ahead by a point or two, maybe by a field goal. I can't remember exactly what the score was, but
you were up by one in the third quarter.
There you go, up by one in the third quarter. The Steelers drive down, and I think they're going to kick a. It was an extra point, so they scored a touchdown, and the extra point was critical, and so they're about to snap the ball, and a gust of wind comes along, and the ball goes all over the place, falls on the ground. They never get the kickoff, and we end up winning the game. And Tony Dungy tells the story much better than I do. He was on the Pittsburgh sideline as the defensive coordinator of the Steelers. And he said, I never saw anything like this in my life. You can't get a snapback because of the wind? Never. I'd never seen anything like that. So naturally, I'd kid him about it, you know, years later. And I said, well, that's just the way it is. That's Bill's luck. So Bill's weather.
The new Bill's luck.
It's one of those kismet things, though. I mean, were you in this sort of Marv Levy's first game in Buffalo, standing across from a coach that you would hire some 15 years later to coach the Colts? There is a strange, strange kismet in all of this.
Oh yes, absolutely,
absolutely.
But here's the kicker on the story. I believe it was after that game. A bunch of us are sitting around with the families in a suite that everybody went to, and Jim Ringo was there. And he was seated next to me, and we'd all had a couple of beers, and he put that gigantic claw grip on my leg and turned to me with his Jim Ringo face on and said, "Are you sure this guy can do it?" Meaning Marv. And I said, "Jim, I bet my life on it. I'd bet my life on it." And he kind of punched me a little bit in the leg. He said, "Okay, if you believe it, I'll believe it." and obviously, you know, I was correct, but it's a long way of answering your question, Scott, that there wasn't a hesitation or a doubt in my mind. I just knew we were going to do it.
Hey, you know, in the kismet of things, when you're talking about the revolving stuff with Notre Dame's Tom Clemens and everything, I think that's when my client Mike Kerrigan took over as the quarterback for the Hamilton Tiger Cats. So everything just winds around on itself. But I wanted to mention one other really Marv move that exemplified how he thought the game should be played, his attention to detail. Right there in the beginning, Marv showed his dedication to special teams. And this was evinced when he made a move and this was the first week on the job, as I recall, the day before the Steelers game, which was game 10, I think, you acquired Steve Tasker on waivers from the Houston Oilers. Tell us why this move was made, how it was inconsistent with NFL standard operating procedure, and the way it worked out in terms of the reaction from the Oilers front office guys when you met them.
Well, the Steve had played at Northwestern. He was a wide receiver at Northwestern, and he was our property with the Chicago Blitz. His rights belong to us. So John Butler, myself, Marv had all scouted all the Northwestern players. Denny Green was, as I recall, was then the Northwestern coach. Chris Hinton was their big star, went on to be a first-round draft choice. But Steve was a guy that, you could count on all the time to make big plays, and he was a dynamic special teams player. As I recall, a pretty good return man. And then I had gone to Seattle in the preseason to scout Pete Metzelaars to make sure that he was healthy and performing at a high level before we traded for him a couple of years before. And they played the Houston Oilers. And Steve Tasker lit it up on special teams for the Houston Oilers. Well, Marv had seen him as well. And then John Kidd, who was our punter, was his teammate at Northwestern, Steve's teammate. So you talk about karma or influences converging. Steve was on injured reserve. He'd been, I don't know whether he was hurt or they stashed him there. It was frequent occurrence in those days. But he was due to come off on the Friday before the Sunday game. And so I saw his name come across the wire. Well, not long before that, both John Kidd and another coach on the staff, it may have been Elijah Pitts, because he'd been in Houston as well, came into Marv and said, listen, there's this guy, Steve Tasker, who Houston's trying to wave through. They're trying to bring him back to the active roster. If he cleared waivers, they were going to put him on the active roster on Sunday.
Right, right.
And he's dynamite on special teams. So Marv said, yeah, I kind of remember that. And so no sooner than he walks up the hall to tell me to make the claim, and I bump into him. I said, listen, there's this guy, Steve Tasker, that's John Waivers today. And I saw him play for Houston against Seattle a couple of years ago. He's dynamite on special teams. Marv said, well, I was coming to tell you that exactly. I said, okay, we'll claim it. So we claimed him. And obviously we got him on the claim because we were first in the claiming order. We were, you know, our record was so poor. So we claimed him, got hold of him. I don't think he played against Pittsburgh. I think he drove in, because I remember him driving in with his wife in a Volkswagen bus, in a kind of a hippie Volkswagen bus, which I still kid him about to this day. But that the next day, Saturday, I got a call from Mike Holovec, who is the general manager of the Houston Oilers, who I thought the world of. Mike Holovec had been a star at Boston College. He'd been a great pro player, the first coach and successful coach of the Boston Patriots, and now the general manager of the Houston Oilers, and one of the nicest people you'd ever meet in your life.
He really was, yeah.
And he was furious. He said, what the hell did you do this for? You know better than that. He said, you're not some guy like, you know, some bookkeeper that's a general manager. You're a football guy. You know you're not supposed to do this. And I said, I mean, it's like the priest or the nun or the pastor, you know, that's chewing you out, and you know you deserve it. And you're disappointing him, you know? And so I said, Mike, look, I got to plead guilty, but we're so bad. We just need to get players wherever we can get them. And I know it wasn't the right thing to do. I apologize. I'm really sorry, but I don't think we had a choice. So he said, well, that doesn't cut it. You know, I want you to know I'm really annoyed. I said, okay, thank you. I'm sorry for that, because I think the world of you. So the phone call ended, and then Steve Steve had a great year for us, went on to have a great career, and I hope very soon we'll be in the Hall of Fame because he's the best special teams player of all time, without question. Affected the game in every way. But about a year later, we were at a league meeting, and Mike walked up to me and put his arm on my shoulder and said, "You know what, I'm still teed off at you, but you're a damn good judge of talent."
It's pretty good. It's nice affirmation.
So, you know, so anyhow, so, you know, there we have the beginning of the Bills turnaround. So when we visit the Bills next time, it'll be a far different team than the one we have suffered through these last 3 weeks with our own Bill Polian. What do you say, Scott?
I think it might be audible time. But hey, real quick before we jump in the audible, one thing I was thinking kind of as we went through this, and I feel like you have a unique perspective on this, obviously being in the media. I've always wondered, how useful is it for coaches when they go into the media before they come back to kind of get that look away at the game? Like, is it sort of one of those things where it is what you make of it? You know, how useful do you think it was for Coach Levy to have done the preseason games, have a sense of what the roster was? I wonder what the utility of that media stay is. And just even in sort of, because this is almost kind of like a quasi-audible-ish question, when you think about guys, you know, who are out of the league, like a Rex Ryan or people like that, who have now spent a good amount of time in media, you know, I wonder if there's like a shelf life when you've been in media too long that it's too hard. But we've obviously seen examples with like Coach Vermeil and even Coach Gibbs where it hasn't been a negative. What is that media experience like, and how can that help you kind of either as a coach or a GM when you get back into the game?
Well, I'll quote Joe Torre on the number one lesson that you learn by being in the media, that by and large, like every other facet of society, they're made up of good people just trying to do their jobs. There are some bad apples. You have to identify who they are and steer clear of them. But they're not the enemy. And you know, the more you treat them with dignity and with as much honesty as you can give, the more they'll respect you and ultimately give you the benefit of the doubt. Now you can't get the benefit of the doubt when the W's and L's don't add up. That's for sure. And they will tell you, listen, I'm pulling for you, but I got bosses too. And you have to, when you're in the media, you recognize that. So, that helps. I mean, you take a completely different approach, than you did if you hadn't had that experience.
So I think what Scott was getting at, Bill, was not so much when you go back what your impression of the media is. Correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, but I think what you were getting at is, you know, you live your life in football, you get a chance to step outside the circle where you're now an observer rather than a participant. And does that chance to observe more neutrally from the outside and see the sort of the bigger picture, does that actually inure to your benefit when you come back as a head coach or as a GM, the experience you had make you a better football guy?
Much more eloquent way of putting my question, Rick.
Thanks, Scott. I'm here for you.
I wouldn't call it seeing the bigger picture. I think most head coaches and most general managers see the bigger picture. If they didn't, they really wouldn't get there or stay there very long. I think what it does is give you a different perspective. The competitive juices, if you will, recede. And so you look at things a little more clinically. And so as I asked Bill Walsh one time when he was broadcasting, what do you see that you know is different than what you saw when you were on the field? And he said, you get to look at things with a little bit more open mind. You know, when you're on the field and competing, you're focused only on what it is that you need to do to win the game, not what might be better for you in the long run. Now, if you want to call that the bigger picture, you can. But what Bill was saying to me and what I got from it was, you know, don't dismiss the run and shoot. There's some good things about it. There's some bad things, too. But take a hard look at it. Follow the trends. Those are things that you don't pay attention to when you're running a club. You know, recognize why the Patriots win. It isn't because they always cheat. That's not the case at all.
That's not the only reason. That's not the only reason.
Yes. Well, no. I'm being serious. I'm channeling what Bill advised me to do. You know, I broadcast for 5 years, and I did a lot of Patriot games, and I came away with an incredibly better appreciation of how Bill Belichick prepares and coaches his team than I ever had when we were competing with them. So the lack of competitive fire gives you, a clearer and less biased look at things.
Right, yeah. I think that makes sense. And I can, having been the veteran of watching many games with you from the press box, I can say that detachment is not there when you are the GM or president of a team. So
absolutely not.
All right. On that note, Rick, why don't you throw us into, I think you got a fan question to kick us off in the Audible this week.
I do. And I think it's an interesting one. Bill, one of our listeners says, he's talking about the book, I guess the movie, Moneyball. And he says, Billy Beane felt he couldn't afford to develop personal relationships with players because he had to make, I'm adding this, he had to make intellectual decisions, you know, unemotional decisions. And the listener does go on, in the podcast, you sound close, empathetic, and humane with the players. How do you approach the player relationships? What is the general standard? And I guess I would add, so, I mean, you are more successful than Billy Beane. So if he couldn't get close, you were able to do that and still do your job? Or how would you relate those two ideas of having to be, you know, the green shade guy who's just looking at the numbers and also keeping the humanity of the players and succeeding?
Well, first of all, thank you for the question. It's a great question. Michael Lewis, who wrote Moneyball, I have a world of respect for. Had the good fortune to come to know him and read every one of his books. He's a brilliant writer and a brilliant man. So I don't know Billy well, but I think he probably captured him very accurately. Billy's right and I'm right. and the sweet spot lies somewhere in the middle between the two approaches. In Billy's case, he'd been a major league player. So he knew what a toll the game takes on players emotionally. And I think he wanted to avoid that as a GM. I recognize that. I did not succeed as a player. So in many ways, while not in awe of their talent, I really had incredible respect for their talent and incredible respect for what they go through in a combative sport like football. I've often said, you know, you get close to players because you get to know them up close and personal. You get to know their families. You see them grow. They come in as 21 or 22-year-olds and they leave you at 32 or 33. And they now have their fathers and you know, have families of their own. That's a long time. That's a decade. And so you can't help but be close to them. And more importantly, they bleed for you, literally. And they go out there every Sunday and lay their bodies on the line for you. Yeah, they're making a living, but we're all in it together. And the best teams that I've been around believe that completely. So I always felt that I absolutely owed them the very best I could give them in terms of my job, and that I owed them to give them the best organization I could give them, so that everybody in the training room was going to do their job 100% all the time, and the players came first. Everybody in the equipment room, the same thing. The players came first. You know, everybody in the media, the players came first. In the building, the players came first. I would tell the players every year, I don't care if I'm talking to the commissioner. It doesn't matter. The senator, anybody but the owner, my door is open. If you want to come see me and I'm on the phone with anybody but the owner, my assistant will tell me to hang up the call and you come in and tell me what's on your mind. And many times I may tell you, you need to go talk to the coach. You're talking to the wrong guy. But my door is always open. Now, does that cause you difficulty emotionally when it comes time to let a player go? Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, does the general manager have the last call? Yes, absolutely. But if you have a personality like mine, where you care a lot about the players, you need to surround yourself with people who are more detached. And that's what I did. I always had people on my staff who were more detached, who could say, yeah, Bill, I know this is breaking your heart to let this guy go, but we just have to do it. It's time. Here are the numbers. Here's what the grades tell us. Oftentimes, the coaches and so-called players, GM, would be together in terms of feeling for a player. And as a GM, I learned that I had to temper the coach's feeling, whether it be the head coach or particularly position coaches. They never want to let go of a good player. And they don't see that, you know, time has passed and it's time for him to go. But I think you have to balance. If you're like Billy, you have to try and have people around who pat the players on the back and tell them how much you appreciate them and make sure the organization is player-centric. If you're a person that takes the approach that I did, you have to have people around with the green eye shades who tell you, no, it's time. Now, I was a good enough evaluator that I knew it anyway. You know, I didn't need much pushing or much evidence to tell me in my heart it's time. But it doesn't make it an easy conversation. And one of the nicest compliments I got, it was a completely backhanded compliment, but I treasure it to this day. Larry Feltzer, the columnist I told you about in Buffalo, wrote when I was let go that one of the reasons I was let go was that people around Mr. Wilson, he meant the treasurer at the time, Jeff Littman, felt that I was too much of a player's GM. And I thought, if you're going to get fired, that's a darn good way to to be let go.
There could be worse.
As a matter of fact, in football and pro sports, it's not when you're a GM or a coach. It's not if you're going to – it's when you're going to get fired, it's a good reason to be fired. Because everybody's fired at some point, right?
Everybody gets fired. All right. Well, I will wrap it up with a little bit of a hat nod and head fake to what we're going to get into next week. As next week's show is going to be a little different as we kind of dive into some things and some of Bill's observations from the first 7 weeks of the NFL. But to that end, as we've done the past few weeks, any big takeaways from week six in the NFL? I know I have a big one in terms of it's always that going for two thing at the end of the game. We saw it work out and not work out. The analytics obviously tell you should go for it, but didn't work out for the football team yesterday. But a couple of really interesting things beginning to emerge in the NFL. Bill, what were some of your takeaways from week six?
Well, let's start with the two-point conversion. It was the right call. The play was open. And the Tennessee linebacker just made an incredible play to knock the ball away from a completely open man that the Houston quarterback was about to hit for the two-point conversion. So as one of my great friends, Mike Murphy, used to say, tip your cap. They get paid too. They made a great play. Nothing wrong with the call. Nothing wrong with the execution. The other team was better on that play. As far as the analytics are concerned, as you know, with two-point plays, I pay no attention to that. It's not valid at all because football is a game of matchups.
I just set a softball up for you.
Yeah,
I know you did. Football is a game of matchups, physical matchups on a week-to-week basis. Those matchups change depending on health and other issues. So there's no validity to a season-long, we should go for it all the time on fourth and one, or we should go for the two-point conversion all the time. The only thing that's made it even a conversation, much less relevant, is the fact that we now kick a 33-yard field goal rather than the former extra point. So that makes the choice a little more difficult for the coach and brings in another element, which, of course, is whether or not the field goal kicker is reliable. Is he healthy? Is the snapper healthy? What are the weather conditions? All of that comes into play. But again, none of that is affected by the analytics. Analytics work in baseball because over 162 games, people are what they are. Football's 16 games. People play hurt all the time. Matchups change on a weekly basis. It really has no relevance. There was a second part to that question. Was there not? Oh, yeah. It was what I saw. Some interesting things. Tom Brady's arm strength. Pay close attention to that as we go down the stretch. He's going to have to rely a lot more on timing than he did in his salad days with the Pats. So he needs more work. Bruce Arians has said this on my radio show, as a matter of fact. He needs a lot of work with the receivers to get that timing down. So, you know, everybody's putting them in the Super Bowl this morning, and they played a great game. But the timing issue is and the practice issue is meaningful going forward. Bruce will handle it fine, but just be aware of it. Secondly, Green Bay better learn how to handle blitzes. They better learn how to block them. They better learn how to where the outlet receivers could be, should be. And you know, for years I've said that their offensive line is really a function of the offensive system, the run game, and the greatness of their quarterback. And when the offensive line was challenged yesterday, it crumbled. It was sad to watch. It was hard to watch. So they got to do some work there. And some of it is systemic. Find a way to pick up or negate those blitzes. Because Todd Bowles with the Buccaneers just tore them to pieces. I'm trying to think here. San Francisco. Those of you who had thrown Jimmy Garoppolo off the Golden Gate Bridge, be glad that somebody gave him a life preserver and came back to lead your team against the Rams last night.
Yeah. In the words of Warner Wolf, not so fast.
Yeah. That's right. He's really a good quarterback. And he's good enough to win with. And then finally, I don't want to throw more dirt on the Cleveland Browns, but they got a problem with Baker Mayfield. He's not reading defenses, and he gets panicky. And makes bad decisions when he gets panicky. And that's not a good sign. So Kevin Stefanski, with that whole team, has a job to do to bring them back down to earth and to get the most out of Baker Mayfield. Now, for Steeler fans, I hate to say this. But they lost an incredibly important part of their defense in Devin Bush. It's a shame. He'd come in and made the defense whole again. He's the biggest playmaker on the front. I know J.J. Watt gets all the, you know, the headlines and so on, but he's the most important cog in it, and I hope they have somebody who's close to his ability to be able to step in and play for him, because when he was healthy, that was my pick for the Super Bowl in the AFC, because what they did to Cleveland yesterday is what they'll do to a lot of teams. With Big Ben back, with the Notre Dame kid stepping in and playing big time at receiver, with James Conner healthy and a very good tandem in the running back, offensive line's always great. Defense is suffocating. I could see a clear path for them all the way, and it was not surprising that they dismantled and beat up Cleveland the way they did. But now without that linebacker, that defense is not going to be the same. So I hope they have they're not going to replace him, but the guy that comes in and plays in his place has to play at a high level.
Let me ask one follow-up, because I have ESPN on in the background while we were doing this, and they had just flashed up something saying, and Bill, I want to get your take on it. Is this the end for Baker Mayfield? Should Cleveland be looking to do something else? I mean, do you still see that he has so much talent that if he can be taught to do the thing, to not make the mistakes that he makes, he could still be a star in the league? You know, tell me about his potential, the kind of continued investment they should make in him. Or in a general, also in a situation like that, how do you know when it's time to cut bait?
Well, we're doing another show here.
All right. I'm giving everybody their money's worth.
Rick, I think that's a good segue preview into next week. Yeah, I mean, let's start blowing through. Like, are we worried about the pass rush in Indy and Tennessee yet? Or I think we save it.
Hang on.
We save some bullets in the gun.
Let me just get my one question answered here. Let me go on.
All right.
It's a nuanced answer. First of all, I'll tell you what I told someone at ESPN who said this to me years ago about Cam Newton. I said, Cam Newton's a star, you know? Can he? I said, he's not a star. He's a guy who has the capacity to do wonderful things, but he doesn't do them consistently enough for you to win. So maybe in your eyes he's a star because you like the flashes that he shows, not in mine, because I'm talking about winning. So Baker Mayfield's not a star. He's a commercial star. He's a television star. He's a media star. He is far from a football star, and was before this game yesterday. Does he have the talent of Patrick Mahomes? No. He just happened to be drafted number one. So was Trubisky. You know, that doesn't mean they're the most talented guys in their class or in their league. I would say he's probably slightly above the middle, talent-wise. His height's an issue. His eyes are an issue. I don't know if you can correct that. Fast eyes, as you know, is one of the most important attributes that a quarterback can have. And his aren't as fast as they should be. Can you train them and get them better? I think so. Can he be a winning quarterback in the National Football League? We'll find out quickly, because he's got two great receivers, two great running backs, a decent offensive line, and a decent defense. So we'll find out by the end of the season if he can be a winning quarterback. But has he regressed Or has he progressed? No, because under pressure yesterday, he flushed to the right and threw it up for grabs on more than a couple of occasions. And that's not good enough to win.
Yep. Well, there you have it.
I'm not switching to progressive yet either. I mean, that's no.
I mean, I don't know. He is pretty good. He is pretty good at those commercials, though.
Those commercials, again, another show. Those commercials were great in the beginning. Now, I don't know. I feel like we've seen it.
You don't like the book club.
Yeah, no, no. All right. All right, on that note, we will call it an episode today. And again, we're super excited about next week, so please pour in some fan questions at IFBillPullian on Twitter. We will be sure to hit it next week. Super special episode of the Inside Football Podcast, where we will cover these topics and many more as we take a look at the first 7 weeks of this NFL season from Bill's unique perspective. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Stay safe, everybody. And we'll talk to you next week.
Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.